they got to fix. They got to drop one or two players maximum at a time. They can't consistently have three, four dead.
Well, they had the right idea as to just pushing right on A after they got B because C was being lost, but there's never a problem with going back and rotating to your home flag and taking that guy out. So many people get caught up with, you know, the fast gameplay of domination on this map, where sometimes, you know, it's fine to just rotate back to your flag.
Commentary from last year's Call of Duty Championship. That's right. Call of Duty isn't just one of the world's most popular video games. It's a professional sport. The best players in the world will descend on LA this weekend for the championship, and the top team will walk away with $400,000. We'll talk about that later on. But first, as Cherry just mentioned, the Senate's Democratic Minority Leader, Harry Reid, says he will not be seeking re-election next year. He took a nasty fall while he was working out at his home on New Year's Day, and he broke ribs and bones in his face and damaged his right eye pretty severely. But in a video message, he says that is not why he's retiring.
These bruises I have on my face, on my eye, are an inconvenience. But trust me, they're nothing compared to some of the bruises I got when I was fighting in the ring.
Reid grew up in Searchlight, a small Nevada gold mining town that had seen better days. His father was a miner. His mother washed clothes at one of Searchlight's 13 brothels. He became an amateur boxer, and he was known as a pugnacious, feisty senator. For the last 8 years, he served as the Senate Majority Leader, but in January, he had to hand over the gavel to Kentucky's Mitch McConnell. Steve Sebelius is a political columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and he's here now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Madeline. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you. Well, in an interview today on KNPR, Las Vegas's NPR station, Reid said he's not retiring because of his injury or fear of losing his reelection fight. And I'm just wondering, is that really why he's retiring? What do you think?
Well, I think there is a lot of truth to that. His injury has, I think, slowed him down. And kept him out of the office and off the floor, which is his natural environment. He's kind of had to have been confined to his home, and I think that's given him some time to really think about it. But the reason in that video that I think we all saw was that he said, look, if I run, the amount of resources that are going to need to be directed to Nevada to get me reelected are going to detract from other states where we have expensive races. And I don't want to see that. I want to see us recapture the majority. And I think that probably was one of the biggest factors in his decision.
Right. And his known nemesis, I should say, are the Koch brothers. He has really taken them on. And I think he was afraid of them sparing no expense in ousting him in 2016.
They would no doubt have put a ton of money into this state to defeat him because he has just vexed them. Harry Reid, as you mentioned, comes from Searchlight, Nevada. He never really forgot those roots. And if you look at his public career, he's reserved his harshest criticism for people such as Mitt Romney, who he said had never paid taxes during the 2012 campaign, the Koch brothers, people who have inherited their wealth and who haven't had to really work for anything the way Harry Reid did. And so I think he would have enjoyed that fight, though. And by no means is it certain that that Koch brothers' money would have helped a Republican get into office, because there's one uncanny thing about Harry Reid, and this is really why Republicans hate him the most, is he knows how to win, and he keeps doing it.
Albeit barely, though. He squeaked by in the last election and the one before that.
Well, actually, his last election was a relative landslide compared to some of his victories. He came closest to political death in 1998 when he won by just 428 votes out of the entire statewide total. After a recount, it ended up with that just razor-thin margin. But Harry Reid had learned a lesson a long time ago. Whether you win by one vote or whether you win by a million, you still win. And so he's eked out these victories over a period of years when any normal politician in the same position would have been dead. Harry Reid just does not stop fighting. And as I said, he knows how to win and he keeps doing it.
Okay, so who is likely to replace him in Nevada?
Well, there's a slew of people who want to do it. Today, he endorsed repeatedly our former Attorney General, Catherine Cortez Masto, who's now an executive with the university system here in Nevada. She's probably the Democratic favorite, although there are some other Democrats that may want to get into the race. On the Republican side, there's no shortage of people. Congressman Joe Heck, who's from down here in Las Vegas, Congressman Mark Amadei, who's from the northern part of the state, and I think our state Senate Majority Leader, Michael Roberson, who's in the midst of a legislative session right now, has also looked at this race. One person I wouldn't put at the top of the list or maybe even on it at all is our popular Governor Brian Sandoval. I really don't think he has designs on going to Washington, D.C. So although his name is mentioned often, I don't know that he is going to want to be a part of that race.
Now, Nevada has been described as a purple state. What are the political demographics these days? Which way is it leaning?
Well, we had in the red tide or red wave, whatever you want to call it, in 2014, we saw the state Senate, the state assembly, all constitutional officers and the governor's office go red. It's the first time that has happened in decades. So right now we're a little more reddish purple than we are bluish purple. But I think that was an anomaly based on the national trends. And I don't think that's going to be repeated in 2016 when we have a Senate race now open, a presidential race open, and some of these other races that are going on. So I think that there is enough Democrats here. They outnumber Republicans by about 69,000 or so statewide. If those Democrats are mobilized, then I think it's going to be more blue than red come 2016.
Okay. And can some of that be attributed to Harry Reid's success politically and his power?
Unquestionably. Harry Reid has built a machine here that's really incredible. That machine has always essentially served Harry Reid and served his need to get reelected. It was robust in the years that he was on the ballot, a little less so in the years when he hasn't been on the ballot. But Harry Reid loves to meddle. He loves to meddle in every race from the president of the United States all the way down to the cable television district in some of these rural parts of Nevada. And so he's been able to kind of pick people to run for various offices. And that Reid machine, as we like to call it, has definitely, when it fires on all cylinders, it runs an almost flawless campaign. The way we saw it the last time he was up, when he ran against Sharon Angle in 2010, it was just an almost flawless campaign, a thing of beauty to watch. So yes, that registration, I think it can be attributed not only to Reid, but also to the Obama efforts to get people registered when he first ran in 2008.
Steve Sebelius, political columnist for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Turning to California news now, the state is relaxing the restrictions on where registered sex offenders can live. A 9-year-old ballot measure bans all sex offenders from living within 2,000 feet of a park or a school. But yesterday, California's Corrections Department said it's going to stop enforcing that law, except for people considered high risk or who have committed crimes against children. Janice Bellucci is a lawyer and president of California Reform Sex Offender Laws, a nonprofit that's been advocating to ease the residency restrictions, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us more about this change and how it would work.
Sure. What CDCR has announced is that now it will not make a decision, a blanket decision, about everyone on parole that they must, in fact, stay away from schools and parks. And instead, they're going to make those decisions on a case-by-case basis.
And why did this decision come about?
Their decision actually flowed from a decision by the California Supreme Court decided earlier this month.
And then that was involving San Diego, right?
It was. And the decision itself was very narrow in that it only talked about San Diego County and parolees in that county.
And from what I understand, it basically said this violates their basic constitutional protections, right, to have this blanket prohibition.
Absolutely. And we were very encouraged by the court's decision, though we think that it didn't go far enough.
Because you think it should apply to all offenders, ex-offenders?
Actually, not. There may be some registered sex offenders to whom residency restrictions should apply, but right now the current law, as you earlier stated, applies to everybody on the registry, regardless of their offense, and really, more importantly, regardless of whether or not they pose a current danger to the public safety.
Okay, so what about these residency restrictions? Do they in fact work? From what I have read, there isn't really any scientific evidence proving that they do reduce recidivism.
You know what? You're absolutely right on that. And the California Sex Offender Management Board, which in fact is our state experts, a group of individuals recognized as experts in our state, they have said that residency restrictions do not actually increase public safety. And in fact, just the opposite, they decrease public safety.
Yeah. And so the idea that a lot of us have of sex offenders lurking in parks and near schools, that's not really accurate when it comes to the reality of sex offenders. Most victims know the perpetrators. Most of these attacks happen in the home.
Yes. Yeah. So here we have a law that's focused in one direction, and it's not where the real dangers lie. So as a mother of two daughters, I want to be focused on where the, you know, really the dangers are. And so if you look at the fact that most children who are sexually assaulted are done, it's done by 93% by people they already know, teachers, coaches, members of the clergy, and family members. Most of them occur, by the way, not in public places like parks or even schools, but they occur in very private places, usually homes and schools. So homes and in private places, you know, inside of the school.
Friends' homes.
But,
yeah.
You know, that idea that people have, it's just a complete myth that there's some stranger standing on the corner ready to kidnap and sexually assault your child are just false.
Now, a report by the California Corrections Department found that the number of homeless sex offenders in the state increased 24 times soon after this law, Jessica's law, took effect. And you've worked with some of these people, I understand. So why is it just that they cannot find a home that doesn't fit within those parameters of being 2,000 feet away, or are there other reasons?
No, that you're absolutely right. So there are places, you know, in our state, for example, the entire city of San Francisco is off limits to registered sex offenders. Again, regardless of what their offense was, it might have been nothing more than urinating on the side of a highway. The city of San Francisco is off limits, but there's other places, including down in Los Angeles. And but for an order by a L.A. Superior Court judge, registered citizens in L.A. would have very few places that they could live.
So what is the solution? Because there is a high level of public distaste for any kind of accommodation when it comes to sex offenders.
Well, I really think it's time for us all to stop reacting emotionally and to start looking at the facts. So we talked about some of them, about who it is that actually sexually assaults children, where those assaults occur. And quite frankly, you know, there is a lot that could be done with regard to prevention of that. And one of the things we need to do is get parents focused on, you know, who it is, again, who is most likely to sexually assault a child, and teach parents how to prevent those things from happening. You know, it's almost like if you're looking in one direction and the danger is really 90 degrees away, then you're not focused on the real danger. So I think that there is a lot of prevention that can be done. Another thing that really needs to be done, too, is actually to have some counseling available for people who have the medical disease called pedophilia, who might, in fact, have feelings toward, you know, wanting to sexually assault a child. And right now, unfortunately, if somebody has a feeling like that, if they should go to a counselor, the counselor has to report, as a mandatory reporter, as is law enforcement and even attorneys, if, in fact, somebody has touched a child inappropriately. And that, as you can imagine, makes a lot of people who could, in fact, be, you know, prevented from harming a child, it prevents them from going for professional support.
Right. So it's actually more dangerous then to bar them from being reintegrated into the community, because you can't keep
Absolutely.
Your tabs on them if they're homeless and who knows where they might be.
Right. And one of the things I think that everybody needs to think about, too, is that it's not just the people on the registry who are being affected. It's also their family members. And families are literally being torn apart by residence restrictions. So many of them, for example, have a family home. They can't afford a second residence. And because they can't be at that home, even if they own it, they can't be living at that home. They are actually torn away from family members. You know, it could be their parents. It could be their spouse and their child or children. And many times when this happens, the person who's on the registry ends up in their car, if they're lucky, living in their car, sleeping in their car overnight. And or that's if they're lucky. And if they're not lucky, they end up sleeping on the street.
Well, quickly, what are the numbers? How many of the sex offenders who are released, how many of them are hardcore serial offenders versus the kind you mentioned who maybe offended once or maybe were arrested for exposure or something like that?
Sure. Well, the best information that I've been able to get a hold of, and I believe it came from the Association for Treatment of Sexual Abusers, I believe it's about 10%.
10% of the hardcore.
Are hardcore. Mm-hmm. 10% of the people on the registry. And these are people who pose a current danger to public safety.
And there are, from what I've seen, 800,000 registered sex offenders in the United States.
Yes, in the whole United States there are.
Okay. Janice Bellucci, President of California Reform Sex Offender Laws, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we want to know what you think. Is it a good idea to relax the rules on where sex offenders can live? Tell us why or why not. You can call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, forget March Madness games. This weekend, athletes will compete in the Call of Duty Championship. It's serious business, serious athletics. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. March Madness tournament games will be played at Staples Center this weekend. A few blocks away, there will be another less physically athletic competition, the Call of Duty Championship. The popular series of first-person shooter video games is having its third annual tournament at LA Live, and joining us to talk about that and the phenomenon of video game tournaments is Matt Helgeson. He's senior features editor at the website Game Informer. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Okay, so esports tournaments, not new necessarily, but they've been around for a while overseas. When did they become huge?
I think we've seen a pretty steady growth over the past decade, though I would say in the last 4 to 5 years, I think there's been a real exponential growth, particularly in the U.S. The U.S. has always had a competitive scene that dates back to probably around the mid-90s, but it was fairly small and unorganized for probably about the first decade. In South Korea in particular, which is really sort of maybe the birthplace of what we'd call the modern competitive gaming or esports scene, it's been very robust for a number of years. I was over there in 2007 and saw some tournaments of people playing StarCraft, which is a popular game there at the time. And even at that time, they had teams that were sponsored. You know, they had a 24-hour television station over there on cable that was devoted to coverage of esports and competitive gaming, much like ESPN is here for traditional sport.
So is it actually a sport, a competition, a bona fide competition, or is it mainly advertisement for the particular games or promotion?
Oh, I mean, it's very much a competition. Whether it's considered a sport or not, I don't think is tremendously important question to me. It's certainly a competition, certainly at a very high level, and we're seeing a new breed of professional players that they make their money doing this. They are training and living in houses together and doing this 24/7, 7 days a week, and at the higher levels, they don't have day jobs. You know, this is what they do. And some of that money comes through sponsorships. Some of that money comes through money that's earned from streaming gameplay sessions on either YouTube or services like Twitch or Major League Gaming. It's taken very seriously, and it's very, very competitive. There's a lot of competition.
How much money can they make, these top gamers?
It's hard to say. Most of them, there's obviously, pretty big prizes being handed out. Like, for instance, this weekend at the Call of Duty Championships, we'll see a $1 million prize pool divided amongst the top eight finishers out of 32. The top team will get $400,000. But for a lot of them, I think they actually make more money off endorsement deals and, like I said, streaming content. If I had to draw sort of a parallel to a traditional sport, the structure of it is probably more similar to professional golf, where each player and each team is sort of their own individual operators. They can sign endorsement deals with different manufacturers, or some are endorsed by like Red Bull energy drinks, very involved in the scene. And then they also supplement that by winning and placing in tournaments over the course of the tournaments in the year.
Okay, there's one team that is the team that everyone's talking about. It's called Optic.
Yes.
And I just want to play a clip of tape of them talking to each other during a tournament game last year.
I'm going pro.
Oh my gosh. It's so intense.
It was hectic, yeah.
Overmodulated the entire time.
That I would say is typical of the professional gaming scene. It's very much something that it's a lot of young guys. I would say that like most sports, it your peak years are definitely from your late teens to probably your mid to late 20s. Mm-hmm. And it's in many ways it's a very macho, very competitive world.
Is it mainly guys?
Yeah, there are definitely some female teams that do pretty well, but yes, I would say that the majority of probably the top competitors are male. The Asian teams are very good, especially in games like League of Legends and Dota and StarCraft. The Korean, Chinese teams can be pretty dominant. America mm-hmm. is a little bit more of a first-person shooter country.
A Call of Duty.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I think Call of Duty, you'll see the American teams maybe be a little more dominant. Optic's based out of Chicago. And Optic is known, the big storyline, I think, moving into this is that Optic has retooled their team of four, their main team. They are very well known on social media. Their kind of star is a guy by the name of Nadeshot, and he is very, he has, I think, over a million Twitter followers. He's very, they're very flamboyant. They talk a lot. As you heard, they yell mm-hmm. a lot. So they're very well known. They're very successful. They have a huge following. But this is the third annual Call of Duty Championships. And the first 2 years, they actually finished third both years. So they haven't brought home the gold, so to speak. So I think the big storyline is Optic is sort of the biggest, most well-known team. The Yankees in baseball would be a comparison there.
Yeah, but everyone hates the Yankees.
Well, I think there's, some love-hate going on with Optic in the scene as well. I mean, they have their followers, but I think they, there's also people that, are kind of cheering for them to fall.
Yeah.
This year they've had an extremely good year on the tournament circuit this year. I think they were 13-1 at one point, and they've done very dominant performances on the qualifying rounds to the Call of Duty Championship. So I think it's perceived that this is sort of their year, that the team is performing at a very high level right now, and that they're sort of the presumed favorites going in. So I think that's going to be a lot of the drama surrounding, can Optic finally close the deal and bring home the championship.
So this is a drama that people can watch online, obviously, not just live at LA Live.
Yeah, they, the live events can be pretty big. The League of Legends championship was actually held last year in the Staples Center where the Lakers and LA Kings play, and I think they had 11 or 12,000 people there. In Asia, they have very big crowds and stadiums frequently and increasingly here. But the main thing that I think is the reason that esports has broke through in the last 5 years is the proliferation and popularity of sort of streaming services like Twitch, which is very popular, Major League Gaming, and to some extent YouTube. This will also be distributed through Xbox Live, which is Microsoft's online service to their Xbox One console. Once it really got to the point where people could watch it online, that's when it sort of really took off and found its niche.
Matt Helgeson, Senior Features Editor at the website Game Informer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we would love to hear from you. Is a video game tournament the height of absurdity, or is it just as valid as basketball or tennis, football, anything like that? Weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, reviews of new movie releases this week, Home, Get Hard, and While We're Young, each one targeting a very specific demographic. We'll tell you if they're worth seeing after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Finally, a little variety at the movie theater this weekend. Coming out today, a family-friendly animated flick, a raunchy comedy, and a movie about 40-somethings trying to relive an imagined youth. Alicia Malone is host of Malone's Movie Minute, and Scott Mance is the film critic for Access Hollywood. And together, they host a YouTube show. It's called Profiles with Malone and Mance.
Yay!
Hello! Hi, you two.
Great to be here.
Well, nice to have you. First up, let's talk about this DreamWorks animation movie. It's called Home, and it's about what happens when a misfit alien meets a plucky tween. Here's a clip.
Knock, knock. You'd say, who's there?
You are there.
No, just ask me.
Well, who is there?
Now I say, the interrupting cow. Now you say, the interrupting cow who? Let's just do it. Knock, knock.
Who is there?
The interrupting cow.
The interrupting
Moo!
Cow. you did not let me finish my response. I was to say the interrupting
Moo!
Cow. Oh, yeah, you did it again. Oh, that is the joke.
Huh. Knock, knock.
That is the joke.
Knock, knock. Who's there, Scott?
This movie is...
bad.
Boring. This is an animated film from DreamWorks. They're not quite like Pixar. This movie, Jim Parsons voices an alien who his team comes to Earth, invades the Earth, and he helps a little girl, voiced by Rihanna, get reunited with her mother, voiced by Jennifer Lopez. It's just a very weak comedy. There's a lot of energy to it. The animation is great. The 3D is very good. Kids will love it, but no one else. Adults might want to just stay home and skip it.
Wow, that is... that's not your usual enthusiasm.
No,
Scott.
It's not.
No.
It's not. You know, I love movies, but there's just not a lot to recommend us.
Yeah, I agree. The animation is very colorful, but the thing that I have a problem with is the casting of the voices, because I think when you're casting star voices for animation, you want them to not be distracting. But it's hard not to hear Rihanna, and it's hard not to hear Jim Parsons, because they both have such distinctive voices.
And then especially since Rihanna's music is being played throughout the film, I understand.
Yes. And so is Jennifer Lopez. She has a song on the soundtrack as well. So it feels like a marketing tool to sell music and sell albums more than it does to make an entertaining and engaging movie for both grown-ups and for kids.
Exactly.
You know, the thing about Jim Parsons, I mean, you know, he's a multiple Emmy winner for The Big Bang Theory, the TV show, very popular TV show. And you could just tell that, like, he was having a blast in the VO booth, kind of like we are right now, having a blast doing this. But it just is so distracting. You're right. I felt like, okay, yeah, that's definitely Jim Parsons I'm listening to right now.
And the jokes aren't funny. As you just heard.
No. And so are they thinking that this is going to be a franchise?
Well, it's not projected to open huge like How to Train Your Dragon. You know, those movies were great. Both of those films were good for kids and for grown-ups. What's missing from Home is the wit, the intelligence, the clever humor that those two other movies had, and especially the Pixar films had. It's aimed really just for kids and no one else. They won't mind. They're going to be less discerning. It's only 90 minutes long. But for grown-ups, it felt like it was twice that.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so maybe we can just wait in the lobby for
Yeah, go minutes. See go see something else.
What about Get Hard if it's at the multiplex?
Should we talk about that?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, let's play a little clip from it first. It stars Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart.
Hello? Hello?
You ready for it? Oh, that burns! Pepper spray, bitch! Rule number one, you always be on guard, okay? Because on the inside is somebody waiting around every corner, though. You are. Prison school is in session. You already failing.
Yeah. I'm so glad I hired you. This is just what I need.
Oh. Alicia, give us the premise. I like Kevin Hart. He's really funny. Is he good in this?
I like Kevin Hart. I like Will Ferrell. Yeah. I'm not so sure about this film, but basically Will Ferrell plays a stockbroker who is sentenced to maximum security prison, and he's worried he's not going to survive in prison. He's worried that he might basically get raped. So he hires Kevin Hart, who is a car wash attendant who he assumes had been to prison, to teach him how to get hard in order to survive prison. It's very offensive. Very offensive. Not all that funny, but at least it offends everyone equally. All races, all religions, gay, straight, everyone gets offended in this movie.
But is it supposed to be offensive? Is it supposed to point out our racial inequalities and our homophobia, et cetera, et cetera? Or does it revel in all that?
Well, if revels in it in all the wrong ways, if it went about it in a way that was clever, that was smart about it, then that would be one thing, because that would make it sort of a satire with something to say. But this is just a movie that's just throwing anything against the wall in terms of over the top and offensive jokes, just sort of seeing what's going to stick. I mean, it's an equal opportunity offender. It's a over the top comedy. And like Alicia said, the jokes aren't very funny. I mean, there were a few moments where we laughed.
Yeah, but there were a few funny jokes. And I don't mind an offensive movie if it is funny. And if, yeah, you're right, if it says something about society, but this doesn't.
Yeah, it really doesn't.
So I mean, it's no Blazing Saddles.
It's no Blazing Saddles. Now, there's a great example of a movie that was also, if you want to be offended by it, sure, because it was groundbreaking back in the early 70s.
Yes.
This is no Blazing Saddles. You know, Mel Brooks would have done a much better job directing this movie now at his age than Ethan Coen, who directed it. And he wrote the screenplay for Tropic Thunder, so you sort of expected this to be a much, much better film. But Get Hard is a limp excuse for a comedy.
Nice.
There you go.
Yeah,
there's your
pull
quote right there. Okay, do we need to say anything more about it?
Well, if you like Will Ferrell and Kevin Hart, they just do the same thing all the time.
Yeah.
So there's more of the same. More of Kevin Hart being crazy and energetic, and more Will Ferrell jokes. But it just didn't work, unfortunately.
One more thing about Will Ferrell. I don't need to see his bare butt anymore. It's been done.
It.
Every chance he has in his movies, he shows his butt. I get it. It's a running gag. But I was over that back in 2003 when Old School came out. Okay, we know what your butt looks like. Let's move on.
You're going streaking.
Okay, so far, two strikes.
Yeah. Two strikes.
All right, we're going to go with a third movie now and see what we get. This is While We're Young. It stars Naomi Watts and Ben Stiller as a 40-something couple who become obsessed with a 20-something couple. Here's a clip from the trailer.
We met this interesting couple.
What's the rumpus, Rednecks?
I like how engaged they are and everything.
It's like their apartment is full of everything we once threw out, but it looks so good the way they have it. Being around them energizes you.
It's infectious.
Okay, so the young couple played by Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried. And is the casting
good? The casting is great.
Good?
I mean, in this film, Noah Baumbach, who is a great storyteller. He's sort of like Woody Allen, but less neurotic and more has his finger on the pulse of what's going on. Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts, they play this mid-40s couple, not married, no kids. So they're not young, but they're not old either. But they're finally
kids
realizing.
Kids makes us old. Is that what you're saying?
Well, because they're asked all the time, when are you having kids? When are you having kids? And take it from me, that is really annoying. I mean, I totally related to this movie. And that's what I liked about most of the film, was I really thought that what he was saying about being in their couples, especially couples without kids in their 40s, he really nailed it. But then the movie turns into something else. It ends different than it starts. A subplot in the film regarding Adam Driver's character. He's an aspiring documentarian, which is what Ben Stiller's character is. It becomes sort of battle of wits between those two guys, and then the movie sort of goes along that route and it becomes more of a prominent story. But up to that point, I thought the movie was very, very good, and overall, I did like it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I love these kind of character studies, very talky films, and that's what Noah Baumbach does really well, relatable characters. I related to this movie as well because I'm kind of in that age when some of my friends are getting married and having kids, but then I also don't relate to the younger generation as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it will make a lot of people relate to the story, and it also might make a lot of people uncomfortable because it does show some truths about our lives and the age that we're living in. I also loved that the younger couple, they are all into the low-tech stuff. So they have vinyls, they have VHS, they prefer not to Google something, they just want to think of it. Whereas the older couple are like, well, just pick up your phone and Google, and they're all high-tech. I thought that was really interesting to point out.
It's an interesting generation gap to look at between couples and or people generally in their 40s or even in their 30s and younger people, more adventurous people like Amanda Seyfried and Adam Driver who are in their 20s. But there's a great line of dialogue that Ben Stiller's character has, and I wish I'd memorized it because boy, did I just go, oh my gosh, when he said this. He says something along the lines like, you know, those things that you think are going to happen to you when you get older and then you realize they're happening. And I shook my head. I was like, oh my gosh, that was so right on the money. And Noah Baumbach is a great screenwriter. He did The Squid and the Whale, Greenberg, which is a love it or hate
also
movie.
Also starring Ben Stiller.
Yes.
Good movie. A lot of people, it's an abrasive film, but I liked it. And then Frances Ha with Greta Gerwig, which I thought was a modern day Annie Hall. Yeah.
So he treads a lot in the same territory where he's dealing with the angst, the generational angst of a certain slice of the demographic.
Yeah,
and it's a pretty narrow slice, right? I mean, it's
it is narrow.
Someone
described
it as lower upper middle white or something class. I don't know.
Well, it's definitely like a New York kind of crowd.
People who live in Park Slope and Silver Lake.
Exactly. And that's why Ben Stiller works so well for his humor, because Ben Stiller can walk the fine line between comedy and drama really, really well. And Naomi Watts is fantastic also.
So this is go see
yeah,
it.
Yeah, definitely
go see,
see
it.
Definitely see it. And if you're in your mid-40s and you have kids and or you don't have kids and you're married, this movie's for you.
I think it's for everyone.
Okay, last out. There's a film out today that no one's talking about, but it stars Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence. It's called Serena. So why is nobody talking about this? These are two megastars.
This has been a bit of a disaster, this film. I remember they shot this just after or before Silver Linings Playbook, So a long time ago, a couple of years ago. And then it disappeared. It was really tough to get marketing, really tough to get out to theaters. And now it's gone straight to video on demand.
Well, the problem with the film, too, is that they had a few different cuts of the movie and it was hard to sell. So when Magnolia Pictures finally picked it up, fortunately, Jennifer Lawrence and Bradley Cooper are now very big stars, especially Bradley Cooper, because American Sniper just is now ended up being the highest grossing movie domestically for 2014. So he's hot right now. So is Jennifer Lawrence. She's an Oscar winner. So why not capitalize on their popularity and release a not very good film and just sort of see what they can get? It's going to do better doing that than it will if it just sort of sits on the shelf. So that's why it's coming out now.
And it's March.
It's March.
So we're feeling a little desperate.
You're after the awards movies. You're not quite at the summer movies yet. You're in that middle ground where the movies right now, they're just not very good. And if you love movies like me and Alicia do, it's kind of a hard time.
I'm looking forward to summer, and I'm not much of a blockbuster girl, but just give me something good.
All right, you guys, thank you so much for coming in.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Scott Mance, film critic for Access Hollywood, Alicia Malone, host of Malone's Movie Minute, and together they host the show Profiles with Malone and Mance. It's a YouTube show. It's also on iTunes just as Profile, so you can download it. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, Warren Olney, the weekend is looming.
The weekend is looming.
Before we get there, let's hear from you and what's on your show at 1
o'clock. Well, thank you. I know you talked about the big money in Call of Duty today. We're going to talk about the big money in March Madness, $1.5 billion to go just for this tournament.
Billion.
This time around, $1.5 billion. None of it, of course, shared with the players who do the work.
Because they're non-professional.
That's right. And among the people we'll talk to is Ed O'Bannon, who played for UCLA, was on the championship team in 1995, and now is the lead plaintiff in a suit against the NAACP, the NCAA, which is succeeding. It won in federal court. It's now on appeal. But it could change things drastically in terms of whether or not these allegedly amateur actors, athletes, student athletes, mm-hmm. as they call them, are compensated. And
so, who gets all that money? The colleges?
Sure. Well, the colleges and various others, the coaches. Yeah. The coaches get $1 million contracts. The kids don't get anything. And in fact, in the case of Ed O'Bannon, when they use their images, for example, in computer games, they don't get paid for that, even though somebody does. I believe the institutions involved, UCLA in this case, gets the money for the use of Ed O'Bannon's image, but Ed O'Bannon doesn't.
Mm. Interesting. Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, it's fun.
To the Point with Warren Olney. And before that, coming up on this program, another movie we didn't get to earlier, Backcountry. It stars a bear. It does. A scary bear. I'll talk with the woman who trains that bear. Actually, it's a pair of bears. Two bears playing one. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A new thriller called Backcountry comes out today. It's about a couple on a backpacking trip, a trip that goes horribly awry. You will not find Chester and Charlie in the credits of Backcountry, but the twins play a central character in the film, the big black bear that is the horrible undoing of that romantic trip into the woods. Now, you don't just send out a casting call for bears. There are specialists in Hollywood whose job it is to provide the animals, get the performances the director needs, and keep the cast and the crew safe, of course. Dana Dubé provided Chester and Charlie for Backcountry. She also works with wolves and llamas and rats and a lot more on a long list of films and TV shows with her company Animal Insight for Film. And she joins us from Vancouver, where she's been working on the sequel to Disney's Adventures in Babysitting. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline.
So the animals in Adventures in Babysitting are?
We have four ferrets that share one role, and we have two dogs sharing a role. So ferrets and dogs.
Ferrets and dogs. Okay, so no man-eaters. And the writer and director of Backcountry, Adam McDonald, he's quoted as saying no crew member on set felt uncomfortable with the bears around thanks to Dana's clear and precise interactions prior to shooting. What does that mean? What were your clear and precise interactions?
We send out the call sheet for the crew the night before we film with bears. And it just goes over the set etiquette for the cast and crew. So they know the do's and don'ts for when Chester and Charlie are on set. And
what are the do's and the don'ts?
Well, to keep their equipment about 4 to 6 feet back from the hot line. And the hot line is an electric fence for the bears. That's sort of their boundary. That's where they know this is their area versus that's where the crew area is. Although the fence is very rarely, if ever, on. But the bears really respect it as their boundary. And again, it really gives them a sense of comfort. It's why they come out and they happily perform in front of, you know, up to 200 people that they've never met before.
So you have a scene, or many scenes, I should say, in this movie of the bears acting ferociously and tearing apart humans,
yes.
Not real humans.
No, and ironically, the reason we were able to get a lot of those shots is because Chester and Charlie are so incredibly good-natured. They're really just lovely, lovely, sweet bears. In the scene with the eating the actor, that's really, of course, a dummy with filled with some chicken wings and cherry pie filling. But I can still go up to the bears while they're eating and put more cherry pie filling on their face when Adam would say, can we get more blood on the face or a little more blood along the side of his head.
Well, how did they become so good-natured? Did you raise them from cubs?
We did. We've had them since they were babies, and they actually grew up on the set of a movie called A Bear Named Winnie, which is the true story about the bear that inspired the Winnie the Pooh stories.
So Chester and Charlie, you raise them from cubs. You call them good-natured, but they're still wild animals, right?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So they are unpredictable.
No, I wouldn't say unpredictable.
They're not tame. They're not like cats.
Well, we don't say tame, but they are trained, but they are wild animals, and we are always respectful of that. So my role is to make sure that they are always happy, loved, cared for, and that they're well respected. And in return, they are very respectful of us. It's a two-way street.
So how cuddly is your relationship with these bears? Can you go up and hug them like a teddy bear?
Mine is, absolutely. Yeah. But that doesn't extend to other people. So that's part of our instructions to the crew on set. We find quite often everybody is on their very best behavior at the start of the day filming with the bears, and then we often have to put the bears up and have another safety meeting because the crew will get too comfortable and they start to, because they see the bears responding so well to cues and they see them so affectionate with their trainers, and they just get a little too comfortable and assume that relationship extends to them.
Have you ever had a bad situation on set with the bears?
Honestly, I haven't.
What about directors? Do they generally get it, or do they sometimes ask you to do things that aren't possible, that the animals just can't do?
Well, I think with proper, with an explanation, they end up understanding what's realistic and what isn't realistic. And quite often, we're able to offer suggestions that still sell that story point. It's usually not so much about the behavior for the animals as the setup for the shot. Mm. So it might be that we just change where that camera position is or where that the actor stands or a rain tower. It's really just creating the right circumstances for it.
Just moving away from bears for a second, because you have other animals, right?
Lots of
other animals. And according to your website, you provided puppy, aggression dog, mules, chickens, lizards for the interview.
Yes.
So how does it work? Does a producer or a director call you up and say, hey, we need some lizards for this movie?
Exactly.
That's it?
Yes. There's usually a bit of discussion between those where we send in some options and suggestions again for lizards, for example. We probably sent in 15 different options for the lizards for that show and then came with the recommendations, the strengths and pros and cons of each of those species.
What are the pros and cons? That they didn't audition well? Or?
No, just some that are more inactive. Even, for example, if we back up to the Adventures in Babysitting movie that we're doing right now, we have four ferrets playing one role. Two of them are like middle-aged ferrets that are really calm, really sweet. We're using those for marks and eye lines and actor interaction. And then we have our two younger, we call them wild childs, that do our action and A to B shots for it. So, and that's true for a lot of different animals, that even in a cat team, you'll have usually at least two, if not three cats in a team, because just like people have different strengths and weaknesses, so do animals. So
you mean three cats would play one role?
Exactly, that all look alike and share the same role. So one that will be really good in arms, a good staying cat, and another one that's a really good action cat.
Action cat.
So Chester and Charlie always, they share roles on a regular basis, and they have different strengths and weaknesses too.
Is there an animal you won't work with? It's just too dangerous?
Snakes.
Snakes?
Not that they're too dangerous, just that I don't like snakes.
Oh. What about alligators or lions? Or?
I have no problem with anything else. Quite happy to work with anything else. With lizards even, or tarantulas. It's really just snakes.
So where do the animals live when they're not on set?
Well, for my animals, they live with me on the property. And so, we have very much an animal's first approach, so we try to make sure that everybody has a companion. So we often have two or three of the same species, or for wolves, for example, we've got eight. Optimal diets, the best of veterinary care, and plenty of room to exercise.
Do you ever have to say to the director, you know what, this is taxing the animal, the animal doesn't want to do this anymore, sorry?
Absolutely. We set limits wherever, whenever we need to. You only have so much food drive and energy for the animal. So if we feel we're reaching the end of that, we'll say you may have one or two takes and then this animal is done.
So I imagine there are people in the animal rights world who think that this isn't really humane to have animals working like this.
I believe you're right. I think a lot of people believe that life in the wild is just romping through a field of daisies. And that's not always the case. By the same token, poor captive conditions, I think, are worse than death themselves.
I just want to ask you, you know, you say Chester and Charlie are really good-natured and sweet, but in the movie, they're supposed to play these ferocious wild animals.
I know.
And they attack, you know, this couple who are on a backpacking trip. I mean, do you ever think, you know, here I am an advocate for these animals, and yet they're being asked to portray them as these ferocious killers, man killers, and that'll influence the audience to be scared and not really understand these animals?
Well, my hope is that it influences the audience to be respectful of the animals in the wild and to be bear aware when you're in bear country. You know, you'll often see driving along the highway people that have stopped and have gotten out of their vehicles and that they are starting to approach wild bears to get pictures. And that's a really dangerous situation.
Dana Dubé's company is Animal Insight for Film. She provides animals, all sorts of animals, for TV and film. And she provided the bears for the new thriller Backcountry, which opens today in L.A. at the NoHo 7. But if you're planning a backpacking trip, I don't know. Maybe skip it. I don't know. Anyway, Dana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Julie Myers aware.
That's good. You're in Jolie Myers country.
I know.
You're backpacking through Jolie Myers country
now. It's a scary country to be in.
It's basically filled with couches and pillows and Netflix. That's Jolie Myers country. Okay, so we talked about the movie Home in our movie roundup today. Uh-huh. Rihanna voices the tween protagonist, which is kind of distracting, according to our critics. The logical question that follows: who would be the most distracting voice actor in an animated film ever? Our Twitter followers had some ideas today. Pat Keene tweets that George W. Bush would be the most distracting in an animated film. And the Iron Pony was also feeling presidential. Bill Clinton, because there is no way that Bill Clinton could be anyone other than Bill Clinton. Like, imagine Bill Clinton voicing the little kid from Up. Nope. Not going to work. And TMZ tweets that Bill Cosby would be the worst pick ever to voice an animated character right now, and I'm going to go ahead and co-sign that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, ending on that note.
Up note for the end of the week.
Thank you. Jolie Myers, have a great weekend. And you have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. Warren Olney up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand again. I'll see you tomorrow. No, I'll see you on Monday. What am I thinking? Have a great weekend.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.